Thanks for listening. The following audio is a teaching from Calvary Tucson's Young Adult Ministry, Ignition. For more teachings, information, or if you'd like to support our ministry, please visit us online at ignitiontucson.com. We pray you're blessed by the message.
We are going verse by verse through the book of Genesis, and this series is entitled Multiplied. Throughout the book of Genesis, you see this theme of multiplication. Be fruitful and multiply. And what we want to carry throughout this book is the idea that God, His desire when He initially commanded us to be fruitful and multiply, was motivated by His ultimate purpose of populating heaven. That we as Christians would be fruitful spiritually and multiply disciples. We've also been looking at how the creation, the 6 days of creation, 7 days rather, how they mirror our regeneration as we're reborn in Christ. When God brings new spiritual life to us, how it mirrors that, how it parallels the 7 days of creation. Day one, we saw that God, in a formless, void world, spoke light. And light shone. And the same is true for us spiritually. When we were unborn spiritually, God spoke the gospel into your life. And there was that moment in time where you believed and the light of God shone in your heart. Your conscience was quickened. We looked at day two when God created the sky. It says He separated the waters and created a firmament. He created an atmosphere where the world could be life-giving and support life. And God does that with us as we're born again. God begins to change things. He begins to create an atmosphere in your life by which you can bear fruit, by which you can be a life-giving, life-sustaining person. Day three, we see God create plant life. And with that, He created the seed. He caused the soil to come forth for burial. And He caused plant life to sprout as a resurrection. And we saw how that was a picture of Jesus, His life, His death, His resurrection. And we saw life beginning to be come forth on planet Earth. As He bears fruit in us, He gives us giftings in order for us to be able to be, again, life-giving. Day four, God creates the hosts of heaven, the sun, the moon, and the stars. We saw that they were given to us in order to govern us for times and seasons, in order to direct us, to give us light. And guess what? As we're born again, that's exactly what Jesus does to us. He's our governor. He's the one that guides and directs us. He's the one that lights our path. He's the one that we can measure life by regarding truth, regarding hope and love. And Jesus is that governor, just like the stars, just like the sun and moon are to us. And tonight, we're going to look at day five and a part of day six as we see the animal kingdom established, created. Tonight's message is titled Feathers, Fur, and Fairy Tales. And you'll understand why as we get going into this. So let's hop right into our text here. Verse 20. It says, "And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good." So God desires this. He speaks it. It comes forth and it happens. These creatures are spoken into existence from nothing. And I love in verse 20, it says that every living creature came forth, these living creatures. This is the Hebrew word nefesh, and it's the first time this word actually shows up. And it's the word used for consciousness, living creature, for actual life. And I want to point this out because biblically speaking, there's a distinction between what we know as plant life on day three and what God calls life, nefesh, consciousness, here on day five and day six. You see, plants, they are alive in the sense that they have a body, right? They're nurtured and they grow. There's life in a sense with plants, but there's no nefesh. There's no consciousness. Plants are not aware that they exist. The animals, on the other hand, have minds. You could say that animals have a body and a mind or soul. That word can be interchangeable. In other words, it has an inner life. It has an awareness of itself. But it stops short there with the animal life. They have the nefesh. But as we'll see next week, as we see the creation of mankind, We have three elements. We have our bodies, the mind, soul, that inner life we live before God, and we have the spirit, a way in which we can interact with a spiritual God. Now, some have pointed out this is the way that we are created in the image of God, that we are like God, a triune being. And that could be the case. That could be how we're created in God's image. But again, I point this out because people have said to me, and they've made the argument that the accounts of the Bible, the narrative of the Bible is false. It's erroneous because if death didn't come until after sin, you would still have plant life prior to the sin when Adam and Eve would eat plants. You'd have the death of cell, on a cellular level, you would have the breakdown of plant cells. And this would be, as according to their argument, this would be death before the fall. But biblically speaking, if you look at it, plant life, again, is not considered actual life. It's not in the flesh. It's not the loss of a conscious mind. Plant life would have been processed prior to the fall through digestion, and it wouldn't have been considered death. Hence the distinction made here in the scriptures. Now, the plants certainly were affected by the fall. We see plants that were supposed to bear fruit, all of a sudden they couldn't bear fruit. They were supposed to bring forth these life-giving blooms that were beautiful or something that literally physically edified. And they were turned from productive plants to thorns and thistles. In fact, what's amazing is some have theorized that the cactus thorn is an underdeveloped blossom. That a cactus thorn, as it develops, it starts the same as a flower blossom, but it becomes underdeveloped and hardened, which is a very interesting theory, right? Could you imagine what our deserts would look like here if all those cactus thorns were actual blossoms? It'd be amazing, right? But plant life was certainly affected by the fall, but not in the way that prior to the fall was there any death. There's plant death after the fall in that you have diseases in plants, you have issues, but there's a distinction biblically between what God considered actual life, that death would come to these animals, death would come to humankind in a different sense than they would to the plant life prior to Adam's fall. He goes on to say in verse 21 here, so God created the great sea creatures and every living thing that moves in the waters. Now, this word here for sea creatures is another interesting word. It's the word tannin. And this Hebrew word is often translated serpent or dragon or sea monster. So he's not just speaking in general terms that God created like the whales and these big sea animals. He's almost alluding specifically to these giant sea creatures that were infamous. There's one infamous sea creature that we read about in the Bible, and he's called by name by the Lord, and it's the Leviathan. Now, did you know this, that the Bible talks about fire-breathing dragons? Do you realize that? The Bible talks about dragons. Now, we see in Revelation, we see allegorical dragons, for sure. How do we know they're allegorical? Because the author actually explains its meaning, its true meaning, that the dragon is actually the devil, right? Or that this great beast is actually an allegiance of nations that have come together. The author of Revelation tells us it's allegorical by giving its true meaning. However, there are places in the Bible where it talks about dragons, not allegorically, in a literal sense. In fact, in the book of Job, I'll share a verse with you. You don't have to go there. God is explaining to Job how he is far above, his ways are far above ours as the heavens are above the earth. And he's saying all these things that he has done, that he's created. He's talking about like the hydrological system. He's talking about like the sun, you know, and how the patterns of nature. He's talking about literal things that God has created. And another thing he brings up as a literal creation is this being, this infamous being known as Leviathan. It says this in Job 41, verse 18, about Leviathan, this giant serpent. It says, his sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Out of his mouth go flaming torches, sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils come forth smoke as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes from his mouth. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to interpret that, unless you're saying this is strictly poetry and allegory, then to interpret that as a fire-breathing dragon. It's exactly what he's depicting. Okay, Sean, come on, let's get real now. You really believe giant reptiles could breathe fire? Let me tell you this. There is evidence of this in nature today. There's a little beetle called the bombardier beetle. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this beetle, but it's amazing. It creates a chemical reaction in its abdomen that explodes in the face of its would-be predators. So you got like a little possum sniffing the back end of this beetle, thinking it's lunch, and this bombardier beetle creates this explosion with tremendous heat that flies out of its rear end, basically, and scares off the predators. So if a little beetle could create such a reaction, who's to say that a giant reptile couldn't do the same under God's design? Yeah, but dragons, Sean, they're like mythological beings. They're in cartoons. They're in, you know, fairy tales, Greek mythology. You know, you can't really believe that these things existed, right? It's funny that you would mention all these fairy tales and mythological stories, because they are. In so many stories and mythological history of cultures, that it makes you wonder. You see, all over the globe, all these different cultures of people on opposite ends of the old world had these mythological stories of the same type of monster, a giant serpent, many of which breathed fire. I was watching a YouTube video of a guy who was being really snarky about the Bible, again, trying to discredit the Bible. His point was, yeah, you see how the Bible is just like all these other mythological stories. The Bible really just copied, the Greek mythology, or rather copied the Canaanite mythology. And he goes through all these cultures that the Bible supposedly was just going along with. All the while, I'm just smiling because he's just giving me all this evidence for the fact that there is so much history regarding a potential dragon in the narrative of the Leviathan. Check this out. He talks about how the Babylonians had a giant serpent in their history. The Canaanites, this giant dragon, right? The Egyptians, the Greek, we know in Greek mythology, the Norse, right? The Viking people, they're all about dragons, fire-breathing dragons. As you guys have probably watched How to Train Your Dragon, right? Which is totally true. No, I'm just kidding. Although I gotta say, that's probably one of my favorite kids' movies. I don't know what it is. I think I just love dragons too. The Hindus, guys, the Hindus have stories of dragons. The Hittite peoples had stories of dragons. The Slavics, the Japanese, and the Chinese, fire-breathing serpents and dragons. The Aztecs in South America, stories of dragons. You have accounts of dragon slayers from Africa all the way up to Western Europe, even as late as 700 BC. I think that's rather interesting. Now, a lot of it, as you read, these are mythological stories, but a lot of these cultures would mix myth with truth, and they would develop these heroes from their past to make their people groups seem like mighty. They would develop stories of the gods that they worship, right? Like Thor. To make their gods seem mighty. And within these stories, you had these fire-breathing dragons. So the world says, oh, it's all myth. But you find them in all these different cultures all across the globe. I think that is a crazy coincidence. So here we have it in the Bible as well, fire-breathing dragons. The great beast, right? The great sea creatures, the tannins. God's saying he created them here on this day. And I know it's crazy. I just want to tell you this, guys, because if you line up the historic evidence with a lot of the fossil records, right? We know scientifically there were giant reptiles that walked the earth. We call them dinosaurs. Who's to say a few species of dinosaur couldn't breathe fire? Or who's to say they had to breathe fire? Maybe there was just one. But what I'm saying is there is archaeological evidence for giant reptiles, and we find it in the Bible as well. Feathers, fur, and fairy tales. That's what we're talking about tonight. But dragons are not the fairy tale that we're going to talk about tonight. What I also love, guys, about day 5 specifically is that day 5, God creates the birds and the fish. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but the birds and the fish are the most colorful creatures, aren't they? You see just the extravagance of some of these fish, the way that they can change color, or these amazing birds. And it just shows me that God is creative. God, he got fancy on day five, right? He breaking out his elementary colors. And I just love it because as you look at these creatures, these beautiful creatures, it shows us not only is God creative, but he delights in bringing joy. As you look at a beautiful animal, there's joy. There's like amazement to that, right? It points to the glory of God. And as you look particularly at the fish and the bird life on day five, God got crazy with his creation because you can see so many of these animals and just you just feel that delight, that joy. Like this is an amazing creature. This is a designed creature. This fish looks like it was painted. This bird looks like the feathers are placed just right to be intentional. Right? It speaks of God's creation. It speaks of God's glory. Verse 22. And God said, God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. So God blesses the birds and the fish. He declares blessing over these creatures. This is the first time where a blessing is declared over something or someone in the Bible. And it's over the nephesh, over the living creatures, that they would swarm within the waters and fill the skies. This was a blessing to God. And of course, it gives the creatures joy as they do this. Isaiah chapter 45 tells us that God created the world in order to be inhabited. His purpose for the earth was to see animals fill it, just to see animals have their lives sustained and multiply. It brings God joy when he sees the animal kingdom doing well and teeming. And guys, the same is true for you spiritually. God will give a similar blessing over mankind in just a few verses here in the next chapter. But for us spiritually, God calls us again to be fruitful, to multiply. And there's blessing in that. You guys need to realize there is no greater joy than sensing that you are in right standing with God. No greater peace in knowing that you're in right standing with God and sensing that you're walking in God's will for your life. I don't know if you've ever had those moments where maybe you interacted with somebody and you really sensed that God was using you, or God just laid something out where you really sense God's hand was on you, and that feeling that comes over you when you're in right standing, when you're walking in God's will and you're aware of it. Man, there's just such joy in that. It's a blessing. God is declaring blessing to us. Be fruitful, to multiply. And when we walk in that, there's true joy to be found. So let's take a look at day six. God will start to create the animals that walk the earth. Verse 24. God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kind, the livestock according to their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Now, there's all kinds of animal life that you can study. You can break it down in all these different categories. But here, it's interesting. God only gives us three categories for the animal world, the creatures that walk the earth, the land animals. He gives us the wild beasts. He gives us the domesticated beasts, right, the livestock. And then he gives us all the other little things that creep and crawl, which would be like, you know, your rodents, your insects, your lizards, all that stuff. Now, if you notice, there's a reoccurring line that God tags through here. I think he's trying to make a point here. Right? He says it's according to its kind, and it was according to their kind that they were created. This again tells us, just like plant life, that God created these animals, these beings, with specific design, and the first day he created them, they had that design. In other words, when God created the fish according to its kind, he created a fish to be in the water and to swim, and the very first day that a fish was a fish, on day one that it was created, it swam in the waters. God created the bird to not be like the fish. He created the bird to fly through the air. And the first day that that bird was created, it was flying through the air. It was created according to its kind. These beasts, these livestock, they were designed and on day one exhibited the nature of their design right away, according to its kind. There's no way, guys, to take what Genesis says here, to take it literally and still try to figure out how evolution works into it. The two ideas are just totally contrary to one another. Again, the only way you can reconcile that is if you call Genesis allegory. Well, it doesn't really mean what it says literally. It's just a poem. It gives us a general idea. You could really, if that were the case, you could make it say just about anything you want. You could read into the scriptures all you want. But there's no way to take it literally and still believe in evolution. Now, I want to reiterate that this is not an essential. I know Christians who, again, believe in old earth. In fact, I had this conversation with my father-in-law. He's a super smart guy. We had this great conversation. And he's old earth. He believes in old earth, that God used millions of years to create the earth. And I disagree, right? We had this friendly conversation. I don't question my father-in-law's salvation. I have other friends that are old earth. He's not evolutionist. He doesn't believe in evolution. That's where he draws the line. But there are some Christians that believe in theistic evolution. And I'm not going to question their salvation. But I will say that, biblically speaking, if you interpret this literally as the Bible intends us, I believe, to interpret it, there's no way you could arrive at evolution, not even theistic evolution, because God created each animal according to its kind. So I'm going to take a moment, because I think it's worth talking about in our Bible study, to talk about evolution just for a little bit, because it's still such a huge theme. It's still such a huge lesson that we have in our public schools. Like, it's taught like it's fact, like it's true science, when it's really a theory that's struggling, if you look at it for what it is. In fact, Darwin himself had issues and doubts with his theory. Darwin said this regarding the possibility of the human eye being a byproduct of evolution, with how complex it is. He said, "It seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree." So Darwin recognized the complexity of creation, the design in creation. He said, he admitted that with certain regards to certain things like the eye, it seems absurd that it would be a byproduct of evolution. You look at the fossil record. Again, the fossil record is significant because it is what the world has to tell us about the past. So we see dinosaurs, potential dragons in the fossil record. There is zero evidence for evolution in the fossil record. There is no transitional evidence for a species going from one to another. In other words, nowhere along the way do you have a fish actually becoming a walking creature, becoming a bird that flies. You don't. We have microevolution, evidence where God actually engineered us to be able to adapt according to our species, according to our environment, which is why you have people who look differently. We've grown up in different regions. Our peoples, for hundreds of years, adapted to different regions. You have dogs who've adapted, right? Their breeding has become more and more refined, and they look a lot different. So you have evidence of microevolution, adaptation, but nowhere do you actually have evidence where one species became another species. They've multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, fruit flies, to the millionth generation or something crazy, and it's still just a fruit fly. A lot of different cool colors, but it's still just a fruit fly, right? There's zero evidence for this in the history of the Earth's record that we call fossil records. There's no evidence for it. Evolutionist Niall Eldridge wrote, we paleontologists have said that the history of life in the fossil record supports the story of gradual evolution, all the while knowing that it does not. This is not a Christian. Man, this is an evolutionary scientist, archaeologist, in a moment of truth. There are these two physicists named Barrow and Tipler, and they looked at the scientific probability of a single cell life form evolving into all the various life forms that we see today. And they crunched the numbers as best they could to say, okay, what is the probability that this could actually take place if evolution is possible, that species can jump from species from one thing to another? How long exactly would that take? And the number was so astronomical, they said the sun would burn out before that it could even take place, to get all the life forms that we have today. And the case was made, actually, there's a man named William Lane Craig. He debates, he's a philosopher, a brilliant man. He believes in old Earth, and he kind of acquiesces to evolution because to him it's not a thing. Because this is what he says to evolution. He says, the probability of evolution taking place, according to these physicists, is so unlikely that if it did, you would have to call it a miracle, and therefore it would be evidence of still a creator God. It's so unlikely, even scientifically. If it were possible for us to jump species to species and transform like that. It's still so unlikely. And it would take way too much time. So I'm hammering this point, guys, because I want you to know that as you look at the evidence, it's far more logical to believe in an intelligent designer who was the causation, something that was outside the laws of physics, outside time, space, and matter, that spoke everything in, that brought everything into it, because science shows us design. It's far more logical to believe that than to believe in what evolution theorizes, what they want it to point to, which is no God. It's illogical and unscientific to say that everything we see came from nothing. That's not even scientific. That's not scientific. And this is actually what the fossil record supports, the creation account. In fact, it's not a coincidence that whenever you have like a hotbed of fossils and dead dinosaur bones, they're all packed in together somewhere. And I don't know if you've watched these History Channel documentaries on dinosaurs, but they always talk about like, what was it that caused this mass dinosaur grave? Was it a disease? Was it a fire? Was there some predator that was burying the bones of these dinosaurs? And they always come to the conclusion, as far as I've seen, that it was a regional flood. That, a flood swept through this valley and packed all these dead dinosaurs in here. And it's because they're right. Although it wasn't a regional flood, was it? It was a worldwide global flood. That's what you see. That's what the fossil records support. So Sean, you're here standing up here telling me that the theory of evolution is the fairy tale, but yet you want me to believe in fire-breathing dragons. Is that what you're trying to say? Guys, what I'm trying to tell you is that there is stronger historic and archaeological evidence for dragons than there is for evolution. Just look at the facts. And yet, if you were to look at the world around us, the world of education, you wouldn't know that. I want to give you one more example. You guys know the dodo bird, the extinct bird that is, it looked kind of funny? Yeah. So the dodo bird, I don't know if you realize this, but the dodo bird was actually this close to being called a myth, a mythological creature, because all they had were these weird cartoon drawings of this supposed bird that nobody had any evidence for existing. And so people were calling it a myth, a mythological bird on these islands. Until scientists did a little more research, did a little more digging, they found out it actually did exist. That there were other scientists who studied these dodo birds. It was this close to being called a myth because of a lack of information and because of a lack of belief and support in it. So yes, I'm telling you that there's more evidence to believe in fire-breathing dragons than there is in evolution. And it's not a coincidence that the Bible touches on fire-breathing dragons and there's no evolution to be found in the Bible. And just think about it. Why is it hard to believe in fire-breathing dragons? My goal at the end of this night isn't to get you to believe in fire-breathing dragons, by the way. I'm getting you to ask these questions. Why would it be so difficult? Why might you be embarrassed to say you believe in fire-breathing dragons? Because it's not status quo, right? Because the non-believing world has written it off as crazy, as fake, as mythological. But think about it. How often, guys, is truth crazy? How oftentimes is the truth something you didn't expect? So what I'm getting at, guys, is that we should be careful to think for ourselves, to not accept something just because it's a popular belief. Not to accept something just because it's culturally accepted in our nation or in our world today. How many cultures have preceded us who have in mass accepted these horrific ideals? I mean, again, one of the classic examples we can go to is World War II Nazi Germany. The majority of people came to believe that the Jews, including a lot of other races of people of different colors, if you weren't white-skinned, you were subhuman. According to Darwinian evolution, the pursuit of a purer race. That's Darwin's full title of that book. That it would be to the pursuit of a stronger human race in order to identify the other people groups that aren't as advanced in evolution. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, was a Darwinian evolutionist. She wanted to specifically get rid of the black population in the United States. And I'm not saying this to be political. This is the truth, and it's not a popular truth. She planted her Planned Parenthoods in the middle of inner city black neighborhoods. And there's audio recordings where people call into Planned Parenthood to donate thousands of dollars, but they want it to be specifically used to the abortion of black babies. And they say, we can do that. We can take care of that for you. These all have their roots, guys, in Darwinian evolution. That's the mindset, okay, that people groups in mass have accepted. Again, Nazi Germany, they killed millions of Jews, among a lot of other people, because they believed they were subhuman. Again, I'm hammering this point because I want us to think critically about what the world around us teaches us, about what it's saying. And I want to tell you that the best source to fact check all that you're hearing and believing is the Bible. The Bible is the most qualified source of truth, not CNN, not Fox News. I hate to burst your bubble there. It's the Bible. And so the Bible ought to dictate what we believe, what we think and feel. We should be like the Bereans, right, who would listen to Paul, but then they would examine the scriptures to see whether the Bible backed up what Paul was actually talking about. That's what we should be. And so if that means we lean more towards believing in fire-breathing dragons than evolution, sign me up, because that's where the Bible leads me. Sign me up, because at the end of the age, when God reveals his truth, the Bible's going to be right. And science, not to bag on science is going to be wrong in a lot of ways. The popular thinking of our day is going to be wrong in a lot of ways. But the Bible, the word of the Lord stands forever. So just a few things in closing. What I find fascinating about Jesus' ministry is that he never seemed to make it easy for people to believe, did he? In fact, oftentimes it seemed like it was opposite, right? He spoke in parables so that certain people wouldn't understand. Why would he do that? And if you look at the miracles that Jesus performed, more often than not, he was performing miracles for people who already believed in him. They came and asked for a miracle because they already believed in who he said he was. And the reason for this is, guys, God is not interested in twisting people's arms and convincing the faithless people that he exists. That's not what God is desiring. God is interested in your faith. He's interested in my faith. So don't be surprised when the truth requires you to exercise faith. Jesus said, I am truth. And if it requires faith to follow Jesus, it's going to require faith to believe the truth, oftentimes. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, well, you know, the hard things that are to believe, well, just check your brain out and just have blind faith. Just believe, guys. Just have faith. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is, regardless of what you believe, you're going to be exhibiting faith. If you choose to be an atheist, if you choose to believe in evolution, you don't have all the facts to prove that either. In fact, as I've presented, you have less facts for atheistic evolution to say that everything came from nothing. That requires a lot more faith, doesn't it, than to believe there was an intelligent designer behind all of this. And so if there is a non-believer listening to this thinking we're crazy, I just want to address you. If you're an atheist, maybe you're tuning in, you're listening to this podcast weeks down the road, I want to speak to you. You and I know that the issue is not ultimately intellectual. The root of the issue here, where we disagree, is a heart issue. I've talked with a lot of atheists who, the more I dig, the deeper we get in discussion, the more I realize they're angry at a God that they claim doesn't exist. That there's anger and bitterness toward God and towards me. I have family members who grew up in really difficult circumstances. They were abused as kids. They were exposed to so much they should never even have seen as kids. And they grew up and it affected their decision making. They made bad decisions. And they grew up bitter and angry at God. And now they're atheists. They say they don't even believe in God. But I know it's because they're mad at God. It's clear. It's obvious. I've spoken with people on the streets when we go out and do missions who blow up in anger when they find out that I am some form of representation of a God. People on the internet, people who call into the church angry, chewing me out about a God that they don't believe exists. It's a heart issue. And if that's you, if you're angry at God, if you're an atheist, I just encourage you, examine your heart. Identify why you're angry and know that God's love is bigger than your anger. You might have good reasons to be angry, but I want to assure you that God, your anger is not big enough to keep God's love away. God loves you. God proved his love for you by sending Jesus to die on a cross for you. And though you may have suffered, you might have reasons to be angry, no one has suffered more. No one has more reason to be angry at the Father than Jesus, the Son. He suffered the most, and he did it out of love for you and for me. And he doesn't blame the Father. He's delighted in the love of the Father because it was God's love that sent him to that cross. And there's love for you demonstrated in that cross. And so if that's you, be honest with yourself, be honest with your heart, set aside the bitterness and allow God to take away that bitterness. He will trade your bitterness for joy. Bring your questions, bring your doubts, bring all your science, but bring them to Jesus. Moving on here, days 5 and 6, secondly, as we bring this, wrap this thing up, we see that days 5 and 6, they're fruitful enough, the earth is fruitful enough to actually sustain life, right? Day 3's fruit has produced enough to feed the animal life, to feed the birds and the fish. And as we mature in our faith, God gives us the same ability to sustain life with our fruitfulness. You see, if fruitfulness was all that God wanted from you, he'd have stopped at day 3. That would have been the end of the analogy. You're saved, God put his spirit in you, and now you have all these cool gifts. End of story. But it doesn't end there. That fruit, that gift that you have, the gifts that you've been given, were given to you not for yourself, but for the edification of those around you. Those trees brought forth fruit, not so that they could feed themselves, so they could feed the animal kingdom. The same is true for your giftings. Get off the bench and get into the game, right? God did not call us into this family to sit around and wait for home, enjoying our own fruits. Exercise your gifts. Love each other and be used to multiply. And then lastly, days 5 and 6, they speak of Jesus. We can see Jesus in days 5 and 6 because here, it's in these 2 days where God creates the flesh and the blood of the sacrificial system. For the first time, we see these animals created to sustain what God would institute in the old covenant, that the blood of bulls and goats would be given so that the Jews could have this system to interact with God by. Now, we know in Hebrews it says that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to atone for our sin. But arguably the most important verse in all the scripture is Leviticus 17:11. It says this: "The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I, the Lord, have given it upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that atones for the souls." So here we have day 5 and 6, God creating these animals, knowing all the while that perhaps just a few years later, a few animals would be killed by himself to cover the nakedness of Adam and Eve, to cover their shame. That a few years later, his son Abel would bring a sacrifice from his livestock and it would be pleasing to the Lord. To know that just a few years later, God would institute the sacrificial system that would prepare the Jewish people for a suffering Messiah. All of this pointing towards Jesus. Pointing towards the ultimate sacrifice, the Lamb of God. We have the ancestor of the Lamb created on day 4 and 5. And we have the Lamb of God fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. And so in the very first week of creation, I think this is amazing because God is already setting up here provision for our salvation. From week 1 of creation, God knew what he would suffer to be in a relationship with you. That he would hang on a cross, that he would pour out his lifeblood in exchange for your life and mine, that we would have the hope of heaven.